Good evening. How are you all? All right, that was less vigorous than I was expecting. Let's see how you're doing by the end of the evening. Shalom Aleichem was a Jewish writer in the early 20th century who also wrote a play. Anyone know what the name of the play was? Shved zu Zayne Yid. Anyone speak Yiddish?
Yes.
Excellent. What on earth does that mean?
Hard to be a Jew.
It's hard to be a Jew. And to some degree that question, I'm sure, hovers over our existence all the time. But it's also been the question in the backdrop of this winter series. We spoke about human dignity as a value the last two sessions, and the next two we'll talk about human harmony, whether that is a Jewish value, and if it is, what we do when it conflicts with halachic life, as I'm sure many of us find ourselves in unharmonious situations, how we deal with that. But today we're going to split that in two, that question about whether harmony is a Jewish value and what we do when it interferes with halachic life, the kind of weeds of legalese and navigating specific cases will be next time. Today we're going to explore the question, is harmony a Jewish value? And against the backdrop of the broader question, is harmony a human value? Is it something shared by other cultures, civilizations in the West and beyond? And before this sounds like, obviously, harmony is a human value, where have there ever been human beings on the planet not in favor of harmony? What is the answer to the Miss World question? What do you want? World peace. Who doesn't want world peace? So it turns out, I'm sure many of you have thoughts in your mind now about people who do not seek world peace as a cultural force, but I actually came across a source only yesterday, which is why it's the very last page, and I'll apologize. I hope these sheets came out okay. I was not here for the printing procedure. They seem okay? Excellent. Are they not double-sided? They are double-sided? Okay, good. So the last page, page 5. Anyone heard of Heinrich Heine? Italian fellow. No, he was a German fellow. Complicated in terms of his identity. Born Jewish, was baptized, and has an interesting experience with religious life. Back and forth about his Jewish identity, bless you. And about he lived and wrote about a century before the outbreak of World War II. And he was a thinker writing about romanticism and other things. And he spoke about fear in the air, about how those in German culture at the time, just beginning to be on the ascendancy. Again, Germany was not an official country. It wasn't a state. It was a collection of principates for a while. And he says, but most of all to be feared, this is the top of the page, we're only going to read the top paragraph. Anyone see what's in the background, by the way? Any Marvel fans? Thor. Anyone know anything more than that? Who he is? What he's holding?
A mallet.
He's not building a sukkah. He's holding a hammer. He's a figure of war, which you can only pick up the hammer if you're worthy. And who at the end of the whole series becomes worthy in addition to Thor? Nobody saw Endgame?
Captain America,
of course. But most of all to be feared would be the philosophers of nature. Were they actively to mingle in a German revolution? And this is riding in the wake, in the shadow of the French Revolution, which of course led to horror and murder and death. Of course it did lead to the deposition of the king in France, but then it led to a slaughter of all sorts of people and literally what was called for 10 years the Reign of Terror. Germany had not undergone such a revolution, but he's now saying the intellectual ferment in Germany is insinuating in that direction. And the things to be feared above all else are the philosophers of nature. Were they to actively mingle in a German revolution? For he has allied himself with the primitive powers of nature, that he can conjure up the demonic forces of old German pantheism. And having done so, there is aroused in him that ancient German eagerness for battle, which combats not for the sake of destroying, nor even for the sake of victory, but merely for the sake of combat itself. and now he's going to praise Christianity mutedly. He's going to say, Christianity, and this is its fairest merit, subdued to a certain extent the brutal warrior ardor of the Germans. The fact that Christianity has spread through the German states has somehow managed to contain this love of battle. But it could not entirely quench it. And when the cross, that restraining talisman, falls to pieces, there will break forth again the ferocity of the old combatants, the frantic berserker rage, whereof northern poets have said and sung so much. The talisman, meaning the cross, has become rotten, and the day will come when it will pitifully crumble to dust, and the old stone gods will then arise from the forgotten ruins and wipe from their eyes the dust of centuries, and Thor, with his giant hammer, will arise again, and he will shatter the Gothic cathedrals. And he essentially goes on to predict what we know went on to unfold in Germany as Christianity falls away, as the reign of religion, that veil that has suppressed that love for war, falls apart, the country erupts in war and violence and death. And he doesn't ascribe that just to a momentary lapse, but there's something about old Germanic culture that celebrated war in alignment with the Nordic gods, that celebrate war again. In fact, if you look at the flags of nations today, it's interesting to note how many national emblems have weapons in them, on the flags, whether they're swords or guns or spears. Well, the sickle or the scythe, I wouldn't kind of go to battle with that myself. I'd probably not go to battle generally. But I wouldn't. That wouldn't be my weapon of choice. But that indicates something else, of course, which is farming, communism. But it is interesting to note. What's on the Israeli national emblem? Not the flag, but the national emblem. There's a menorah surrounded by olive branches, which is an expression, an exhibition of our deepest ambition and aspiration, which on the surface seems to be peace. So it seems like I've actually solved our question. So let's go back to page one, so that I can justify the next few minutes. Now, does the West value harmony? We've said that there is this Germanic undercurrent, and Germany is not the only place in the West, in European history, in human history, that has valued combat, as Heine said, for the sake of combat, just for the sake of war, for fighting, and there's a bloodthirsty love of warriors. But what about America? Is America a place that loves war? We have hawks and we have doves in the foreign policy establishment, I'm sure. But if you have a look at source one on your sheet, we the people, again, other than the fact that this involved throwing off the yoke of British wonders, this is to be celebrated. We the people of the United States, and as we're reading this preamble to the Constitution, get a sense of what are the priorities of the framers, what are the priorities of those who authored our independence. I'm a citizen. We've been hearing a lot about the framers, anyone who's had the news or radio or anything on at any point in the last week. We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. So what are the priorities, at least in the preamble of the framers? What do they seek to assure for the general public? Tranquility, right? Domestic tranquility. At this point, they don't want to be the world's policeman, which is often debated in American foreign policy. Should we go around spreading our values, or should we just let the world get on with it and we're going to deal with ourselves? I think this has been captured by the two-word motto, America first. Everything else we're not going to pay attention to. From the Constitution, again, this is very internally focused. We want domestic tranquility and provide for the common defense. Is there a sense of latent conquest, expansionism? We want to dominate the globe. We want to spread all over. It seems to be at this point in human history, we are content to have a little bit of peace on our own island, and we'll have some defense so that nobody comes to get us. But there doesn't seem to be an appetite for war. Seems to be a value for peace. Now, In 1849, Victor Hugo, anyone know Victor Hugo? Obviously not personally. Anyone know Victor Hugo? Anything he wrote? The Miserables, yes. Les Miserables, if you want to be French, yes. Hunchback of Notre Dame, Notre Dame, as you might say. And at the International Peace Congress, which the theme kind of speaks for itself, he speaks of a vision, and it'd be interesting to see if you feel that it came to be. This was, again, in an age, 1849. 1848 was mass upheaval across Europe. There were revolutions across the Eastern Front with the Ottoman Empire and the Russian Empire, the Austro-Hungarian Empire. The governors and dictators and rulers and princes and kings of provinces changed every year. And there was this Congress of International Peace. Again, the idea that the world would be in harmony, that countries wouldn't be at war, was a distant dream. And this is what he says, a day will come. Anyone ever seen, what's that famous Chaplin movie? The Dictator? Is that what it's called? Right at the end, he gives a big speech. The Great Dictator. Sounds similar. A day will come when there will be no more battlefields, but markets opening to commerce and minds opening to ideas. A day will come when the bullets and bombs are replaced by votes, by universal suffrage, by the venerable arbitration of a great supreme senate, which will be to Europe what Parliament is to England. What's that called today? There is something called the European Parliament, which the European Union is really an economic association. There is something called the European Parliament, which is attached. And the Diet to Germany, the Diet, not a manner of eating. And the Legislative Assembly to France, a day will come when a cannon will be a museum piece, as instruments of torture are today, and we will be amazed to think that these things once existed. A day will come when we shall see those two immense groups, the United States of America and the United States of Europe, stretching out their hands across the sea, exchanging their products, their arts, their works of genius, clearing up the globe, making not desserts fruitful, because we like chocolate, but deserts fruitful, ameliorating creation under the eyes of the Creator and joining together to reap the well-being of all. What a lovely, hopeful, utopian, prophetic image.
Pre-Brexit.
Pre-Brexit. And it is quite timely. I don't know what the date is. Anyone know the date?
It's
Friday.
Right, today's when?
Tuesday.
So in 3 days, Brexit will come. It won't be the end of the European Parliament. They'll still have positions there, I think, but the European Union will be one short. And this, just as a side note, that's why there is so much tension about this matter. Brexit is not just a technical association, but the European Union is 60 years old, thereabout. 60 years. Who here is... Oh, you don't have to raise your hand. Who here is comfortable raising your hand saying you are older than that? Okay, 60 years is the longest period in the last 1,000 that there has not been an open war on the continent of Europe. You, those who raised your hands, have lived longer than the period of time there has not been open warfare in Europe. So the idea that the European Union may fall apart is riddled with anxiety about what may be on the horizon. Of course, there are arguments on both sides of the coin. I did vote in the election, both the last British general election and in the European referendum, but I would never share that with you, my position on that. But merely to observe the anxiety latent in the country and about how significant this is. Because if Britain gets out, and other countries decide we want to be out and everything falls apart, what's holding everything together? And this vision from Victor Hugo was actually repeated in the 1950s by the figure who was voted the greatest Great Britain in history by the British public, who read a particular newspaper. But in a particular paper they did a vote, who's the greatest Great Britain in history, and who do you think was in the top five?
Churchill.
Oh, all right. Who do you think was in the top one? You got it. Shakespeare was there. The Queen, I think, came second. That must have been a blow to the family. But Winston Churchill came first, and he gave a speech about the United States of Europe that he hoped to emerge out of the world wars. Obviously, it didn't happen. The European Union didn't come around until the 70s. And, of course, it doesn't function in this way. We can't coalesce in Europe around a shared culture like America can. We don't have a constitution. We didn't fight a war of freedom against a common enemy. We were each other's enemies. We don't share a language. We barely share a culture. And we share the prejudices of 2,000 years. It's not that easy to get together. Either way, that was Victor Hugo's dream. And after the two world wars, there seems to be a more broad appetite. That we shouldn't just think about domestic tranquility. We shouldn't just think about harmony among our own people. Maybe we should think more generally about the human race, about having something that holds us all together, which of course manifested in the United Nations. Now, source two, we the peoples. What does that sound like? Who decided to start the preamble of the United Nations, we the peoples?
Americans.
An American, not just an American, but an Orthodox Jewish American from New York. The longest serving Orthodox Jewish congressman, which could be 2 months. I don't know how often you've had Orthodox Jewish congressmen, but Sol Bloom had 14 terms in the House, and he suggested beginning the preamble of the United Nations with we the peoples. We the peoples, correct. Meaning that idea that the United States had for itself to ensure domestic tranquility should almost be seen in continuity with the aim of the United Nations. It is kind of an American spirit, and perhaps it's not accidental that it was in some ways formulated by a Jew who had thought about the pains of war and oppression and death and loss and tragedy as the target of all these nations as they fought each other brutally, and getting caught in the crossfire as just an accident of history. We the people of the United Nations have determined to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, skip down, and for these ends, to practice tolerance and live together in peace with one another as good neighbors, and to unite our strength to maintain international peace and security. To ensure by the acceptance of the principles and the institution of methods that armed force shall not be used save in the common interest, and to employ international machinery for the promotion of the economic and social advancement of all peoples. Again, a wonderful idea. What the UN has turned out to be is up for debate, perhaps not up for debate. But at least the idea in itself. Anyone know what the background of Victor Hugo is there? What's in the background? It's very hard to see. And I also got carried away, so I actually put three images in the background, overlaid on top of each other. One is the Isaiah Wall, which is just a few miles from here, outside the United Nations. Anyone know what's on the Isaiah Wall? The clue's in the name.
Plowshares.
A quote from Isaiah: "The sword shall be turned into plowshares, and we shall not know war anymore." And there is actually a statue there of a figure beating a sword into a plowshare. It's very hard to see, and it's not there. It's somewhere in Europe, actually. But either way. Now, we seem to have established that at least in the last 100 years, and again, very much like dignity, it seems to be, as we are experiencing this week, the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, that the Holocaust was a turning point, not just for Jews, but for humankind. Whether the messages and the memories will be forgotten in the years to come, to some degree, is up to all of us, not just in this room. But the idea that it was a turning point, that Europe woke up and said, we've reached rock bottom. We have been treating people with the depths of indignity, and look what war has got us. Hundreds of millions of people have died. For what? And there seemed to have been this, again, this rise of a need to band together to promote peace and dignity and unity and tolerance and prosperity. All that dream that Victor Hugo had in the shadow of the French Revolution and war is precisely what came to be, unfortunately, after it was made a necessity. Now, are all pieces the same? Is peace a Jewish value? Harmony seems to be this value. Is it a Jewish value? Or are there things to which we say, no, we'll take other things over peace? Obviously, this takes its most concrete form in our age with questions about Israel, land for peace. This often is a discussion. Is it worth, are there things that trump peace? Excuse the turn of phrase. Yeah, I didn't mean, alright. I got a call from my parents today because outside of America, the Middle East plan was the top news everywhere. It took about 3 hours for it to trickle through American media, to just pierce through the coverage of impeachment. But it did come through eventually. So that's obviously my subconscious on my mind. And we can talk about that another time. But either way, peace is a value. Is it a Jewish value? So if you turn over the page, page 3, last time when we spoke about dignity, is dignity a Jewish value? We began with Rabbi Sacks and Rabbi Soloveitchik. I didn't search the works of Rabbi Soloveitchik, but something for Rabbi Sacks came to mind. And you should also know there's an excellent feature on his website. Are you all familiar with his website? RabbiSacks.org? You are now, RabbiSacks.org. I'm not getting paid for that. But he has often one the most wonderful quotes, and there's actually a section on his website. There's a British fellow in Israel who took the time to assemble quotes from Rabbi Sacks on various topics, sent it to Rabbi Sacks' office, and they put it on the website, and you can search under peace, tolerance, interfaith, Israel, hope, whatever it is, and you can get some nice quotes out of it. Either way, Rabbi Sacks says, source 4, one day we will learn the lesson of peace. This is in his Haggadah, talking about Pesach, which is creeping up ever closer. Yeah, I don't mean to scare anybody, but I'm starting to have to think about the Shavuot HaGadol drasha, so we should all have to think about cleaning. Or I should guilt all of you. One day we will learn about peace, that war never solved any conflict in the long run, that in victory the victor too is defeated, that in conquering others we diminish ourselves, that only in and through peace do we honor the image of God, that is mankind. Does that sound representative of Jewish thought? No dissenters? Okay, interesting. Is that because you don't want to go up against Rabbi Sacks, or everybody agrees? Because there was actually a very interesting exchange, just comes to mind now, in, I think it was a Jewish Review of Books, but it could have been somewhere else, where Rabbi Sacks and Rabbi Riskin got into a letter, a fight of letters, about whether Abraham led an army. And Rabbi Sacks had a piece like this, where he said Abraham led no army, had no warfare, and spread a message of peace. At which point Rabbi Riskin wrote a whole thing about the Midrashic traditions, and if you look at the biblical text, he conquered 5 kings, he saved his nephew, he did seem to marshal an army, and they had a back and forth about that. I don't know how they feel about each other, but it was an interesting exchange worth looking at. So Rabbi Sacks says peace is a value. Yeah.
If in conquering others we diminish ourselves, then what do we do about Kibush B'chiluk? Is it the commandment?
I'd say that's an excellent question for Rabbi Sacks. I'm happy to divert it toward him, but it's a good question, meaning it's hard to get away from the fact that the biblical text is not averse to war. There is actually there are hard parts to the Bible, to the biblical text. And what's the most difficult part from this perspective of the Chumash, let's say? So Amalek, interesting. Amalek, what is so difficult about Amalek? I'm not debating, I'm just asking. Complete annihilation. This isn't just defensive, and it's not just armed people. It is men, women, children. It's genocidal, in essence. In fact, Rabbi Sacks, in his book, Not in God's Name, which I think you actually had an event about here with Rabbi Soloveitchik, Mayor Soloveitchik, Rabbi Sacks takes the position that we need to stand up against violence in the name of religion. And he has one very small chapter called Hard Texts, in which he says that every religion has difficult texts. That you look at, and the one he quotes, not just Amalek, is actually a scene in Bamidbar, when they go to war with Midian, in the wake of the corruption of the Jewish camp, and there's a plague, and then they go to war against Midian, and they come back from war, and they haven't slaughtered all the women. And what does Moshe Rabbeinu, our greatest prophet, say to the Jewish people? He said, what is wrong with you? Why didn't you kill all the women? At which point we lane very quickly, and we never look back. And Rabbi Sacks said, what do we do about that text? Which I thought was an excellent question, and turned the page, and it was the next chapter. So that wasn't that helpful. But he posed the question that we need to confront these, and they can be read differently. But his basic claim was, fundamentalism is when you go from text to application without interpretation. I would push back on that myself, but we don't have to go into that now. But everyone has hard texts, anyone has hard histories we need to confront, and actually we're going to turn to that in a moment. Now, Rabbi Sacks makes that claim. Anyone heard of Jean-Paul Sartre? Sartre, if you're French and you've got the tongue for it. So Sartre, one of the major figures in the existentialist movement, which is a turn of phrase invented just to make other people feel inferior. Existentialism was a movement of broadly depressive thought. I'm not going to talk about people per se, but depressive thought that we don't particularly have a purpose. God is dead. That is not a declarative statement. That is a quote in the name of Nietzsche. Although there is a nice, what are those GIFs? What are they called? Memes? Something digital, where it says a quote, God is dead, signed Nietzsche. Underneath, Nietzsche's dead, signed God. Either way. Yeah, there you go. So Jean-Paul Sartre was part of this movement. He wrote a play called No Exit. Anyone see The West Wing at any point? There's an episode called No Exit, based on his play, where Toby and the new speechwriter, his name's Josh Molina, I don't know the name in the show, Will, thank you, get stuck in a room together and can't get away. And the ending line of No Exit, hell is other people. So that's the kind of people we're dealing with. Either way, Jean-Paul Sartre, in the wake of World War II, 1944, in France, wrote a work that in English is called Jew and Anti-Semite. In the French, it's Réflexion sur la question juive, Reflections on the Jewish Question. And he wrote this. And this was in praise of Jews and trying to dissect what it is that generates anti-Semitism. Again, trying to pull apart what could possibly give rise to such blind and thorough hatred of people you do not know. That's worth reading, but this is just a quote about Jews. The Jews are the mildest of men. He hasn't met everyone in Shul, obviously. Passionately hostile to violence. That obstinate sweetness which they conserve in the midst of the most atrocious persecution, that sense of justice and of reason which they put up as their sole defense against a hostile, brutal, and unjust society is perhaps the best part of the message they bring to us and the true mark of their greatness. So Jean-Paul Sartre seems to feel that we are, as a people, passionately hostile to violence. 100 years later, do people characterize Jews in that way? Would you characterize Jews in that way? I'd say that his idea that the sole defense was because that was all we had for 1,000 years. We didn't have an army, we didn't have a government, we didn't have weapons, we didn't have power in any way. So it was our sole defense, not particularly out of choice. It was our sole defense, again, out of either providence or fate or whatever you want to call 2,000 years of exile. But it's quite possible that 2,000 years of that persecution led to a character where we were passionately hostile to violence because we were never meeting it out. Our experience with violence was on us. So of course we're hostile to that. Either way, those are two views which again come up with the same idea. Jews are hostile to violence. Peace is the ultimate goal. Now, we need to go back in history. Is this true throughout the ages? Of course this is not always true. The biblical text you've mentioned. There are Jews who don't seem hostile to violence. There are kings that seem quite happy in the Book of Kings and elsewhere to go rampaging. David leads wars of conquest. Even David who wrote the Psalms had wars of conquest. So let's look at Rashi, which struck me a few years ago. Always on this topic, it pops to mind. Source 5. Rashi asks a narrative question about the book of Genesis, which we often neglect to think about. The book of Genesis opens with a chain of events that lead to sin, redemption, and repentance, including Gan Eden, the flood, and the building of the Tower of Babel. Now, if I were to ask you in isolation, what was worse, objectively, which sin was worse? The time of Noah or the Tower of Babel? What would you say? Let's identify. What was the sin of the age of Noah? What led to the flood? What was it that God saw that he didn't like? He didn't like Hamas. Again, topical. What didn't he like? He didn't like theft, violence, lack of social skills, to put it mildly, right? That was the flood. What was the Tower of Babel's great iniquity? What was the problem?
They rebelled against Hashem.
They rebelled against God. So, you're God.
Thank you.
No problem. What's worse? The time of Noah or the Tower of Babel? Objectively, what would you think? Tower of Babel. They're coming against God. They're rebelling against the creator of the universe, the forger of all existence. So there's some people stealing. We've got to deal with that. But if you rebel against me, you contradict nature, existence, and creation. So Rashi, among others, says, so hold on a minute, I don't get the punishments here. What happened to the guys who did some thieving? Wiped out. Drowned. Again, it's worth thinking about in the context of Noah. Again, we lane these things so quickly. But you have to remember, how did Noah come out of the boat? When he came out, what did he see in front of him? Dry land, right? We have these images of pastures and trees and the animals skip free. If we think about it historically, what is more likely that he saw when he came out? Corpses everywhere. And in fact, there are artists of the last two centuries that have painted precisely that image. Noah coming out and seeing human corpses. It doesn't say anywhere that they were cleaned up. It has been cleaned up in our imagination by artists and others and readers. But it's horrific to imagine. People were wiped out. Tower of Babel. They rebel against God. What's the punishment? Go for a walk. Learn a new language. Take a year off. Go and explore. Find yourself. And Rashi says, Ezukasha, I don't understand this. Sheldor HaMabel or Sheldor HaPlaga? Which was worse? Rebelling against God? Or a little bit of bad social behavior. Elu lo pashu yad be'ikar. They didn't rebel against God. They just stole off each other. The elu pashu yad be'ikar. They struck the root of existence. Lehilachem bo, to overthrow God. The elu nishtafu. The elu lo nevdu mina olam. Those were wiped out, drowned, and they just went for a walk. They had dispersion. Ela shadar hamabul hayu gazlanim v'haytam riva b'neihem. But during the time of the flood, they were fighting with each other, lakach nevdu, and then they were lost. Ve'ilu hayu nohagim avareus b'neihem. And those people who rebelled against God,
did it together.
At least they loved each other. At least they were together. At least they weren't fighting. Lamadata in bold, what does this teach us? Shesanui hamachloket v'gadol hashalom. How great peace is. That God says, I will wipe out an age of people who don't get along. They rebel against me, I'm a big boy. Or a big girl. Depending on how you see God, I guess. But I can deal with that. I got a thick skin, metaphysically speaking. But you attack each other and you're out. Peace, it seems, for Rashi, seems pretty primal as a value. And in fact, I just want to take a moment to explore a separate text on this issue. Apologies, I just want to keep track of the time so I don't hold you all hostage again, because I do value harmony. What is the greatest case? Talking of King David, what is the greatest experience in the life of David that shows us that war is not valued, is not celebrated by Jewish thought? He doesn't get to build the temple. What reason are we told that King David was not allowed to build the temple? He had blood on his hands, like Lady Macbeth. He had blood on his hands. Which text tells us this? All right, you already know. Have a look in Source 6. Book of Samuel, the book of Shmuel, where the original narrative is contained. David got home, the king got home, and he finally had some respite. He'd stopped fighting, there'd been no war for a few minutes. The king said to Natan, the Navi, the prophet, Re'ena, see now, Anochi Yoshev Bevet Arazim. He takes a moment to just pay attention to his surroundings. He's sitting in a cedar palace. David is sitting in royal halls. Va'aron ha'elokim, apologies, we won't throw these out. Yoshev betoch hariyah. And where is the Ark of God? It's behind a little mechitza, behind a little curtain. I'm sitting in a cedar palace, me, little David, and the Ark of the Covenant is sitting behind a curtain. Ve'yom Natan el ha'melech, and Natan says to the king, Kol ha'sheh b'levavcha, Lech asek, ki Hashem imach. Whatever you want to do, go do it. God is with you. David thinks, great, I'm going to go build my temple. At which point, Natan goes home and God says, Natan, no, yeah, consultation. I made this mistake. My three-year-old did something good, and I said I would get her a prize, which one I did. My wife said, consultation. You're going to get a prize every day. So, yes, not that I'm the king, but my wife is God. And it was that night. The word of God came to Natan the prophet and said, go and tell my servant David, thus says the Lord, you're going to build a house for me to sit in? He's saying, don't even say it gently. It says, use the power of sarcasm, irony, and rhetoric to tell David he ain't building me a temple. Your days will fill, you will lie with your father, I will establish your line after you, which will come from you, I'll establish their reign. Who yivne bayit lishmi? He will build a temple for my name. Who are we talking about? Solomon, King Shlomo HaMelech. Natan goes to tell David. At no point in the book of Samuel are we told why David was rebuffed. All we're given is that rhetorical question, you should build it in my name? God forbid, says God. How can it be? So we're left pondering for quite a bit of Tanakh about what the problem was. What did David do wrong? We're only left to guess. Look at the next source, source 7, because in the book of Kings, Solomon himself starts raising funds and trying to get armies of workers to build the temple. And as he's reaching out, it strikes him that some of the allies who were close with David, his father, might say, why are you building a temple that David didn't? Who do you think you are innovating in this way? So he defends and says, no, my father couldn't build the temple. There's a very good reason that David couldn't build the temple. And he doesn't say, and God made fun of him for it. What's the answer he gives? David Avi, Kilo Yachol Livnot Bayit L'Shem Hashem Elokav. My father David couldn't build the temple for God. Mipnei HaMilchama, because of war, Asher Tzevavu, which was all around him. What does that sound like? Why didn't they build it? Because he was busy, it sounds like, right? It sounds like he didn't have the time. Not because he was a warrior, but because he was surrounded by wars. Atet Hashem otam tachat kapot raglai. I now have them under my foot. I can do this because I don't have the distraction. I live in an age of peace, so I get to build it. So what's Shlomo doing here? This is the first explanation we have, which is in direct contrast to the previous text. What was the explanation that David got in the first text? Did he get an explanation?
No.
We're told he didn't build it because he was surrounded by war. What is the introduction to the sentence where he's told he can't build it? There was no war. We're being told, it was a time of calm. There was no war, there was no battle, there were no distractions, it was a moment of peace. David sat on his throne, took a moment to look around and say, I've got some time in the calendar, I really need to rectify this. And his son is going to allies and saying, no, my father was too busy. So the Radak rightly says, source 8, Lo rasa legalot lo hatam, he didn't want to tell the reason to the allies. Ki akel mena'o ki lo haya kavod aviv. He had too much respect for his father to start telling allies, oh, my dad couldn't build it because, oh, it's a funny story, let me tell you what happened. Natan came along and said, go for it, and then God told him off, and he told my father, no way, you can't build it, you're not fit. So he just gave him a lie. But the real reason, as you say, is in Divrei Yamim, source 9. And what I want to do is explore three different ways of viewing this excuse that David was not allowed to build the temple, which again will explore whether peace is a primary Jewish value. Rashi again, contrasting Bavel, the Tower of Bavel, and the flood, suggests it is. Divrei Yamim, Ha'elokim Amar Li, this is who speaking? Li is the clue. It was 50-50. Okay, it was 33.3 recurring, 33.3 recurring. David, this is King David speaking. I gave you no context, so that is no fault. Halokim Amali, David says to the people, this again is not in the book of Shmuel. Who wrote the book of Shmuel? Good question. Chazal suggests that Shmuel wrote it, so maybe he's also being deferent to David and trying to exclude the reason. Who wrote the Divrei Yamim? Also not sure, but it's possible that there is a trace here of Davidic imprint that David said something, and I don't want to sweep it under the rug. He is the person who gives us the reason. He was not allowed to build the Beit HaMikdash. Halukim Amali, God said to me, Lo tivne vayit lishmi, you shall not build a house to my name. To my name? Just say, Lo tivne bayti. Bear that in mind. Do not build this to my name. Ki ish milchamot ata, for you are a man of war. V'damim shafachta, and you have spilt bloods. Plural. Damim. Not dam, v'damim shafachta. So what it sounds like here is, you have been engaged in war, you are bloodstained, you cannot build the temple. Now I'd ask you, what's the connection? So he went to war. A lot of good people have had to go to war. A lot of people have fought in defense. A lot of people have killed people they didn't want to kill, but they had to. What's the problem? Was what David did wrong? Going to war?
To do it as a conqueror as opposed to a defender.
Okay, interesting. Maybe the voluntary wars of conquest that he launched were the problem. Does everyone agree that going to war in and of itself shouldn't be a problem for building the Beit HaMikdash? Or do some people feel it doesn't matter, even defensive war would be a problem?
Or is it Lishmi? Is that like, you've already gone to war for my name to like glorify it, so you already did something, so somebody else could do the other part?
Meaning you've done too much already.
Maybe.
It's interesting, there is a Gemara that says if David had built the temple, it would have been indestructible. And David was too great, so we needed to leave it for another age. Could be interesting. I think some people could say, it doesn't matter if it was defensive or it was a war of conquest. If you've been to war, if you've been involved in killing, you can't build the temple because the Beit HaMikdash is a house of peace. It's a house of prayer. It's a house of reflection. And in fact, this does come into halachic life today in a different context. With Kohanim. There is, talking of Yeshayahu, the opening of Yeshayahu is a berating of the Jewish people for bringing korbanot, but living lives without integrity or civility or compassion. And he says, your hands are filled with blood, meaning you keep bringing korbanot and ritual and whatever, but you're not doing anything of piety. And that quote is taken by Chazal to say that you can't serve in the temple if you have spilled blood, if you have killed, which is taken in the halachic context to say that a Kohen cannot duchen if they've killed someone. Now, where does this come up? Let's say before 1948, before 1930. When did this come up? Not that often. But the Shulchan Aruch discusses cases of doctors who've been involved with trying to save lives and end up losing a patient. And sometimes it can be you're there at the moment, you do something which is an attempt to save someone and they die. It could be as a mohel. Again, in the old days, occasionally that would happen. A child would pass away from bleeding out. And then there would be questions, if you're a Kohen, can you duchen? And it came up in 1948 when Kohanim went to war. Actually, before that, the first question came up in the First World War when Jews were conscripted into the armies on both sides of the war. And then they'd go back home and the question was, can they duchen? And again, there's a back and forth. Rav Avad Yosef has a long piece about this, saying in the context of Israeli soldiers, there were people in yeshiva with me who had killed people. The guy who sat next to me in yeshiva was a tank commander. And he knows for sure. There was a moment, he was looking through the scope, he pulled the trigger, it went, and he knows that people died as a result of what he did. And there's a question, is he allowed to duchen anymore? And Rav Avad Yosef again has a long piece saying, yes, of course, that's a mitzvah. What he was doing was an act of saving people. It involved killing, but it was not murder, it was an act of saving. So there's no problem from that perspective. But Rabbi Soloveitchik, again in America, disagreed with that perspective, at least as it's quoted by Rav Schechter and others, that he said, it's like David couldn't build the temple. Meaning, as a Kohen, any Kohanim in the room? Two Kohanim in the room? Alright, that's not a bad number. That the moment of blessing the people is a moment of channeling God's presence. And if your hands have spilt blood, whether permitted, endorsed, legal, necessity, you can't channel divine presence, which is meant to just emit peace. And he uses David as the model. David couldn't build the temple, even though his wars were legitimate. However, the Radak takes your view and says Damim is in the plural because David spilled blood legitimately, but also not so legitimately. Whose blood did he spill not so legitimately? Bathsheba's husband. Right, because her beauty and the moonlight overthrew him. That's Leonard Cohen's version. But I want to finish at least this portion, just for a moment, with the view... Oh, two more views. One of whom is going to be the most important Jew in human history, of course. The Malbim. But before we get to the Malbim, Rabbi Soloveitchik, I should point out, Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik, who anyone who knows his views generally may see this as an extension of where he stands, takes a view similar to the one we expressed a moment ago, which is David would have been too great. Meaning, actually, we value warriors in Jewish life. We value victory and triumph and war. We're not scared to fight. We shouldn't be scared to fight. We should be proud to stand on the world and stake our ground and defend our people and expand our vision of what it means to be a servant of God. And David's temple would have become precisely that. It would have become the temple of David, not the temple of God. So they needed a figure who had not been a general. Solomon, who was more of a bookworm, who was the wisest figure to have lived but never fought a battle, he should build the temple. So it won't become a temple of Solomon because he didn't have that kind of cult following that David did. That's Rabbi Soloveitchik's suggestion. However, and he would be mortified if I finished with the Malbim over him, but I will. Yes, he's fired me a few times publicly for my post, all in good humor, I assume. But I'll find out someday. The Malbim said as follows. Pay very close attention to Lishmi. What does Lishmi mean? To my name, right? What does it mean in rabbinic parlance? To do something Lishma. That doesn't just mean to the name. What does Lishma mean halachically? For the sake of God, with the right intention. Lishmi. Now, the Malbim, again, this is part of a long drasha that he has, and I just excerpted a short bit, but this is his argument. David was a man of war, he had spilled blood. The first view on this, the Radak and others, he spilled blood, hands are tainted, you can't build the temple, it's a house of peace. In fact, that's his very words. Look at the last line of source 10. Middle. Aval, mena'om livnot bet hamikdash. David was held back from building the temple, shehula shalom, because it's a place of peace. L'chaparat avon, an atonement from sin, ula teret tefillah, and to pray. This is a place of prayer, of peace, of reflection, of atonement, of purification, of purging the soul and directing one's attention to God. You can't have a figure of war to do with death building the place. That's the first reading. The second reading is actually it would have distracted from God's presence because David was too charismatic and great a figure. The Malbim has actually quite an insightful psychological reading here and a theology erupts from it. He says, David was a man of war. What do people of war tend to want? Not people who are what we call armchair commentators, but people who have been on the field of battle. What do they tend to want?
Victory.
Well, victory for a start. And why do they tend to want victory usually? After, not just as they're marching out there kind of with their suntans and their bags, driven with the march, with the, everything off to battle. Once they're on the field of battle and they fought some wars and they've lost some friends and they worry about their own life and maybe they've suffered wounds and they miss their family. What do they want?
Peace.
Peace. They want to go home. They want it to end. And David was a man of war who had spilled blood. He knew the cost of war. He didn't sit in the palace directing this. He was on the battlefield. He wanted peace. And the Malbim says, and this is going to be an ironically appealing and, I guess, repulsive reading. Malbim wanted peace, and that's why he couldn't build the Bet Migdash. Why? Because he couldn't build it Lishmi. He had an ulterior motive. Why did he want the temple? He wanted to inaugurate universal peace. It wasn't about God. It wasn't about having God's presence. It wasn't about having redemption and the Messiah and serving God. It was just about stopping war. David wanted slaughter to end. And God says, in the eyes of the Malbim, if that's what you want, if that's all that's in your mind, if your motivation, if your intention, as you lay up the slabs and the stones of the Bet Mikdash, is I'm going to be inaugurating peace, I'm going to be stopping war, I'm going to be saving lives. This is not a temple about God, this is a temple with human ends in mind. Now again, some of that will resonate, probably the psychological reading will, and maybe not the end, but the Malbim is now complicating the picture and saying peace is a value, but it's not the ultimate value. And in fact, the desire for peace is precisely what disqualifies David from building the temple. Because it is a place of peace, but it can't be built for that, because there is a value that trumps peace. And what's the value that pences peace, that trumps peace? Serving God.
Really?
I'm not declaring that. I'm saying in the name of the Malbim. That's what he's saying. And if you wait around for my dissertation to be published, you can see it as part of his larger view. You could just wait for Surah Shlishit in about 3 years. We'll get there. But we'll touch on that. And hopefully it will be long enough that I can repeat it and no one will remember. So that's the view. Turn over the page, because I said we'd finish on time this evening. Now, we've established that the peace is a value. Rabbi Sacks says it's a value. Sartre says it's a value. Victor Hugo says it's a value. The preamble to the United Nations, the United States, says it's a value. Anybody here on Facebook? Nobody's here on Facebook? There's a few of you on Facebook. So, I'm not an avid user or deployer of social media, but I thought I had a momentary lapse last week, and I put up on Facebook, mainly because we moved the date and I didn't want people to get confused. I put up, anybody interested in what connects Victor Hugo, Jean-Paul Sartre, the greatest human being in history, who we just dealt with obviously, King David, the United Nations, Sol Bloom, and something else, come on Tuesday. So I think I've covered most of those people. But we still need a biblical source. When it came to Kavod HaBrios, our subject on dignity, we didn't have a biblical source that said human dignity is important. And what was the result of that? No biblical source that says Kavod HaBrios is important. What was the halachic fallout of that? The biblical law comes first. There's no biblical source. It's a rabbinic, I don't want to say invention, but a rabbinic legal intervention that says, and of course there was more we could have said last time, that the rabbis valued dignity so much that they entrenched in rabbinic law a loophole. The human dignity superseded rabbinic law. But biblical law came first. Do we have a biblical verse that says peace is a biblical value? The answer is yes. We sing it every single week. Top of page 4. Yeah. From Mishlei. Number 12. Is it number 12? Ashrei Adam Matzah Chochma. Happy is the man or person who finds wisdom. And in this context, wisdom is read by the sages, meaning the true wisdom, which of course is Torah. Daracheha Darchei Noam, its paths are the paths of pleasantness. V'chol nitivoteha Shalom, and all its ways are peace. The Torah's ways are peace. And if you want to see an extreme formulation of how that can be read, look at Source 13, Maimonides the Rambam. Gadol HaShalom, Shalom, peace is great. Not just great in a superlative sense, but Shekol HaTorah Nitna La'asot Shalom Ba'olam. The entirety of Torah was given for one purpose, one single aim: to make peace in the world. We could have a whole share, Maimonides and Miss World. Both want world peace. That's what the Torah is about. That's what the Rambam says. And this is actually in the halachic context. If somebody can't afford more than one candle on a Friday, and you've got a choice between Hanukkah candles or Shabbos candles, and the determination is which comes first? Shabbos candles, because Hanukkah candles celebrate a military victory, Shabbos candles make peace in the home, and this is a context where he says peace comes before war at all costs. And he quotes our pasuk, the Torah is peace. This is not just a rabbinic saying, this isn't an aphorism that's invented in a later age. This is a biblical verse actually from the mouth of Solomon, of Shlomo, who says, the whole Torah, Netivoteha Shalom, all its paths are peace. which, as you can imagine for next time, is going to become very complicated, because I'm sure there are moments in life when halachic life does not feel particularly harmonious or peaceful. And in fact, it is precisely in reaction to this verse, as used by Chazal, I may get in some measure of trouble, but let's be honest, no one's going to listen all the way to the end, that an article was written in the YU Commentator at the beginning of this academic year, suggesting that Jewish thought has a radically different view than it is purported of homosexuality, or should have a different view. Because how on earth can we say with a straight face that the entire Torah is to make shalom in the world, derechei noam, nativoteh shalom, and then turn around and tell people you don't have a place, or discriminate? How can we do that? And the article made a strong argument that Chazal and Halakha might catch up to this eventually, but they're not there yet, and in the meantime we should jump ahead. Now, with that little cliffhanger, next time we're going to have a look at some of the sources when Chazal do confront the fact that there are parts of halachic life that don't seem peaceful or harmonious or pleasant or easy, and how do we compute that with this Pasuk, with this Maimonides, with this Rambam that says Torah is all about peace. So how can there ever be conflict in Jewish life, in halachic life? We'll turn to that next time. We'll have to do some of these sources a little bit next time, but that's we answered question one, is peace a Jewish value? Next time we'll answer the question, what about when it conflicts with halacha? I wish you all a good evening, and we'll meet again in a month. Thank you.